The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're doing something pretty ambitious. We're heading way back, like 6th century BCE back.
Way back. We're going to witness, essentially, the birth of thinking as we know it. Logical, systematic thought.
Exactly. We're diving into pre-Socratic philosophy, specifically through the lens of Catherine Osborne's fantastic analysis. It's really about the invention of rational thought itself.
That's the perfect way to put it. And, you know, our goal here isn't to treat these thinkers, Thales, Heraclitus, Parmenides, like some dusty figures from a history book.
Or like failed scientists who just got things wrong.
Right. None of that. We're looking at them as the actual architects of Western critical thinking. If you've ever wondered where the whole idea of making an argument or needing proof comes from, well, this is the origin story.
And the core of that story, really, is this massive shift they initiated, moving away from what's called mythos.
Which is, you know, explaining things through myths, gods, traditional stories.
And towards logos, which is all about systematic, rational explanations based on evidence, based on logic.
And that fundamental belief that the universe makes sense,
yeah,
we can figure it out using reason, that's the bedrock of, well, everything intellectual that came after, science, philosophy, even just making a coherent point in a meeting today.
So we're exploring how humanity first learned to think critically. It's huge.
It really is.
Okay, so who's our guide on this journey? Let's talk about Catherine Osborne.
Right. She's a distinguished professor of philosophy at the University of East Anglia. Deep expertise in ancient Greek philosophy. Got her doctorate from Cambridge. Definitely a leading voice on the pre-Socratics.
And what makes her take on it so special?
Well, what's really valuable, I think, is her dedication to historical accuracy. She really pushes back against just accepting interpretations from later philosophers, like Aristotle.
Aristotle, who sometimes kind of shoehorned the pre-Socratics into his own philosophical system, right? Made them sound a bit like early versions of himself.
Exactly. Osborne says, no, let's cut through that. We need to go back to the original texts, which are often just fragments, mind you, and understand them in their own time, their own context.
Treating them as serious thinkers in their own right.
Yes. And crucially, she focuses on their method, the how and the why behind their arguments, not just the what's, not just Thales said water, but why did he argue that way? What kind of reasoning was he pioneering?
I like that. It gets us beyond the simple, maybe slightly weird sounding conclusions and into the actual process of thought.
That's her core argument, really, that these pre-Socratics flourishing in those unique Greek city-states around the 6th and 5th centuries BCE, they set new rules for thinking. Rules based on reason, evidence, argument. And those rules shaped everything that followed in Western thought.
The book apparently traces this whole evolution, starting with the conditions that allowed it, like the specific social and political climate in places like Miletus.
Yeah, things like trade, the spread of writing, early forms of democracy. It created this atmosphere where you could question the old ways, the traditional explanations, without, you know, getting into too much trouble.
It made intellectual challenge acceptable, maybe even encouraged it.
And that led to this amazing ongoing conversation. Osborne emphasizes this wasn't just a few isolated geniuses popping up.
It was a chain reaction.
Absolutely. Think Thales, then his student Anaximander critiques him, then Anaximander responds, Heraclitus, Parmenides. They're all building on arguing against or totally revolutionizing what came just before. It's a shared project, developing systematic ways to think about the cosmos, knowledge, reality itself.
Okay, let's get into that. The Milesian Revolution, this quest for the arch.
Right, the fundamental principle. We start with Thales. Famously, he said the arch is water.
The classic example everyone learns.
Yeah, but Osborne points out the genius wasn't that he picked water. It was that he proposed a single natural explanation for everything. One underlying substance, governed by natural processes, not the whims of gods.
So instead of Poseidon caused the earthquake, it's something like the earth rests on water and waves made it shake. Something you could actually investigate.
Exactly. It opens the door to debate, to finding evidence. But then his own student, Anaximander, comes along and immediately shows the power of this new rational method by picking apart Thales' idea.
How so?
Anaximander used logic. He basically said, look, if water, which is wet and cold, was the fundamental thing, how could its opposite, like fire, which is hot and dry, even exist? Wouldn't water have dominated and extinguished everything else long ago?
Okay, that's a sharp point. The world would just be soggy.
Pretty much. So Anaximander proposed something much more abstract, the apeiron.
The boundless or indefinite. That sounds like a big jump from something tangible like water.
It's a massive leap. It shows this incredible step towards philosophical abstraction. He realized the ultimate source couldn't be one of the specific things we see around us. It had to be something more fundamental, something without the specific properties of earth, air, fire, or water.
Moving from just observing to pure conceptual thinking.
Wow. That's arguably the birth of metaphysics right there.
Yeah.
Then comes Anaximenes. He kind of brings it back down to earth a bit, saying the arch is air.
Which sounds like a step back, maybe?
You might think so, but his real innovation wasn't what he chose, but how he explained change. He introduced a mechanism.
Okay. How did that work?
He proposed condensation and rarefaction. Air, when it thins out, rarefies, becomes fire. When it thickens, condenses, it becomes wind, then cloud, then water, then earth, than stones.
So he provided a systematic natural process to explain how you get diversity from this one substance.
Exactly. A clear account of transformation based on observable processes. The Milesians basically gave us the blueprint for a naturalistic explanation of the world.
But just as things seem to be settling into this nice cosmological framework, bam, Heraclitus and Parmenides arrive and throw a massive logical wrench into the works, the crisis of being.
Oh yeah, this is where it gets really deep. Heraclitus. First, he's the philosopher of constant change, of flux. The famous line, you cannot step into the same river twice.
Because the water's always flowing, always different.
Right. For him, reality is change. But crucially, it's not chaos. He believed this constant flux is ordered by something he called the logos.
The logos, like a universal reason or principle?
Kind of. A rational structure underlying everything. And this structure is defined by the unity of opposites. Strife and harmony, hot and cold. Life and death, their tension is the order of the cosmos. Change happens through these opposing forces.
Okay, so change is fundamental, but it's an ordered change. Then comes Parmenides.
Who takes one look at Heraclitus's flux and says, using pure, cold, hard logic, nope, impossible, change can't happen.
Whoa, how does he argue that? That seems to fly in the face of, well, everything we see.
His argument is incredibly powerful, even if the conclusion feels wrong. He starts with a basic premise. You can think about and talk about what is being, existence, but you cannot logically think about or speak about what is not, non-being, nothingness. It's literally inconceivable.
Okay, I think I follow that. You can't picture pure nothing.
Right. So if what is not is impossible, then several things follow. Change requires something to come from nothing or pass into nothing. Or for things to be separated by nothing, a void. Since nothing is impossible, change must be impossible.
Wow.
And plurality, having many different things, requires non-being to separate them. Also impossible. Therefore, reality being must be one single thing, eternal, unchanging, indivisible, motionless.
So the world we experience with our senses, movement, variety, change, Parmenides says that's all just an illusion.
He calls it the way of seeming. Deceptive appearances. Only pure reason following logic can grasp the way of truth, which is this unchanging, unified being.
That's staggering. It creates this huge problem. Parmenides' logic seems inescapable, but it contradicts our everyday experience, which feels more like Heraclitus' flux.
Precisely. And that becomes the central challenge for the next wave of thinkers. They mostly accept Parmenides' core logic, that nothing can truly come from nothing, that reality at its base must be eternal. But they need to somehow explain the change and variety we obviously see. They need to save the phenomena, as it were.
This leads to the pluralist solution, trying to bridge that gap.
Exactly. Empedocles is a key figure here. He agrees the fundamental stuff can't change. So he proposes four eternal, unchanging roots, what we now call elements, earth, air, fire, and water.
Okay, so the building blocks are permanent. How does change happen then?
Through mixing and separating, he introduces two cosmic forces, love, which brings the roots together, and strife, which pulls them apart. All the changes we see are just different combinations of these eternal roots, driven by love and strife.
So permanence in the roots, change in their arrangement. Clever?
It is. But perhaps the most radical and weirdly modern-sounding solution came from the atomists Leucippus and his student Democritus.
Ah, atoms. I've heard of them.
They took Parmenides' unchanging being and smash it into countless tiny pieces. An infinite number of eternal, indivisible particles called atoms.
Okay, so they pluralized the one. But how does that solve the no-change problem, especially the issue of movement? Didn't Parmenides rule out empty space?
This is their genius move. They make the incredibly bold claim that what is not non-being does exist, in a way. They call it the void. empty space.
So they basically said, okay, Parmenides, maybe you can't think pure nothingness, but empty space is physically real and it's what allows things to move.
That's the essence of it. They're positing atoms, the what is, and void, the what is not, reimagined as space. They created a system where eternal bits of reality could move, collide, combine, and sepiate, generating the world we see. It's a purely materialistic, mechanistic explanation.
That sounds remarkably like early physics.
It really does.
Yeah.
It's an astonishing intellectual achievement, reconciling logic and observation.
Now, before we wrap up the thinkers, we should quickly mention Pythagoras, right? He took things in a different direction.
Definitely. Pythagoras and his followers focused less on substance and more on form and structure. For them, the ultimate reality wasn't earth, air, fire, or water, but numerical ratios, mathematics, harmony, the cosmos as an ordered mathematical system.
And then the whole focus shifts with the sophists.
Right. People like Protagoras, they turn away from speculating about the fundamental nature of the cosmos and focus squarely on human life, ethics, politics, rhetoric, how society works.
Which leads to that famous, maybe infamous saying, man is the measure of all things.
Exactly. It signals a move away from searching for objective cosmic truth towards a more relative, subjective understanding based on human perception and convention. And that really sets the stage for Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle.
What an incredible journey in just a couple of centuries, from what's it all made of, to how does logic limit reality, to how should we live? Okay, let's boil this down. What are the absolute key themes Catherine Osborne highlights that we should take away?
Well, theme number one has to be that massive shift, mythos to logos.
From myth to reason.
Yeah. The idea that the universe isn't just random or controlled by unpredictable gods, but is actually intelligible. It follows patterns. It has underlying principles we can uncover through rational inquiry.
And why does that still matter?
Because it's the foundation of accountability. Think about it. Every time you ask for evidence, demand a logical explanation, question an authority figure. You're living out the legacy of the pre-Socrates. We expect reasons now. Because I said so, or because the gods willed it, just doesn't cut it anymore in most areas of life.
Okay, good point. Theme two.
That fundamental tension we talked about. Change versus permanence. Heraclitus versus Parmenides.
The flux versus the unchanging one.
Right. This debate forced thinkers to grapple with the very nature of reality. And it's not just abstract. Think about navigating life today. Everything feels like it's constantly changing: technology, jobs, society.
Total flux.
So how do you find stability? Some kind of permanence? The pre-Socratic answer, especially from Heraclitus, suggests looking for the underlying patterns, the logos within the change. Understand the principles governing the flux rather than trying to freeze the river.
Find the order in the chaos. Okay. And theme three.
The crucial distinction between appearance and reality. Parmenides really drove this home, but Xenophanes touched on it too, criticizing people for making gods in their own image.
Questioning whether what we see or what tradition tells us is the whole truth.
Exactly. It's the birth of critical skepticism. Are our senses reliable? Are our assumptions valid? This is so relevant today. We're drowning in information, misinformation, spin. The way of seeming is everywhere.
Like political ads or social media feeds?
Precisely. The lesson from Parmenides, maybe softened a bit, is that we need to use our reason, our critical thinking, the way of truth, to cut through the noise, challenge appearances, and get to the underlying reality or the most logical conclusion.
Filter the BS, basically.
Basically, yes. Use logic as your filter.
It's amazing how potent some of their actual words still are, even as fragments. Let's share a few key ones.
Yeah, these little snippets pack such a punch.
Okay, first, Thales, all things are water. We've discussed it, but the key again isn't the water itself.
No, it's the radical attempt to find one single unifying principle. The first move towards reductionism, explaining diversity through simplicity.
Then Heraclitus. You cannot step twice into the same river.
This captures the essence of flux, but also hints at the logos. The river as a concept, as a pattern of flowing water, persists even though the actual water molecules are constantly changing. Permanence lies in the pattern, not the material.
Love that. Okay, third, Parmenides' core principle. What is, what is not, is not.
This is the bedrock of his deductive logic. It basically says thought and reality are bound together. If something is genuinely inconceivable, like non-being, it cannot exist. It sets the limits of reason as the limits of reality. Devastatingly simple, profoundly impactful.
And finally, maybe marking the transition away from the pre-Socratics, Protagoras's man is the measure of all things.
Yeah, this signals that huge shift. Truth is no longer sought in the objective cosmos, but becomes relative to human perception, human needs, human conventions. It opens the door to subjectivity and sets up the ethical and political focus of later Greek philosophy.
So this isn't just fascinating history. How can we, like, use these ideas today?
Oh, definitely. Take the Milesian search for the arch. Mm-hmm. You can apply that method as first principles thinking.
How does that work in practice?
Well, instead of just copying competitors or relying on analogy, this worked before, so let's tweak it. You break a problem down to its absolute fundamental truths. Like, if you're designing something, what are the core physical laws involved? If you're creating a strategy, what are the undeniable facts about the market or human behavior?
Like the atomists breaking things down to atoms and void, you strip away assumptions until you get to the non-negotiable basics.
Exactly. Build up from there. Another big one is intellectual humility, drawing from Xenophanes' critique. Remember his line? If oxen could draw, their gods would look like oxen.
Huh. Yeah, basically saying we project ourselves onto everything.
It's a powerful reminder that our perspective is inherently limited and biased. Recognizing that helps cultivate open-mindedness, makes us less dogmatic, more willing to listen to different views. It's crucial for navigating disagreements today.
And maybe one more, managing volatility using Heraclitus.
Absolutely. We live in that river of constant change. Trying to stop the flow is futile. Heraclitus, through the idea of logos, suggests we should instead try to understand the underlying principles driving the change.
Find the patterns in the disruption.
Yes. If you understand the dynamics of how a system evolves, you can navigate the changes much more effectively, finding stability not by resisting flux, but by understanding its structure.
So, wrapping up, what's the biggest takeaway for you from Osborne's look at these thinkers?
For me, it really boils down to the invention of method. It wasn't necessarily that their specific answers about water or air were right. It was that they forged the process. Rational argument, logical critique, systematic explanation, building on predecessors. That's the engine that drives all intellectual progress, even now.
That's a great point. For me, it's the sheer audacity of it. The fundamental belief that the universe isn't just some chaotic mess or divine playground, but something intelligible to human reason, that we can figure things out. Engaging with how they first tried to do that, wrestling with these huge questions, it genuinely gives you better tools for thinking clearly about pretty much anything today. It demands rigor, but also wisdom.
Well said. It's foundational stuff.
Truly is. It makes you realize how much we owe to these ancient minds asking the first big why and how. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.